the world is watching with their ears.
If you record audio for any purpose, chances are you want it to be heard. You want to attract the largest audience possible who can hear your message. That's where we come in. We're CyberEars.com, a revolutionary internet service that will host your audio files and help you promote and track its popularity. Considering hosting a podcast to the world? We have all the automated tools to make the process as simple and easy as it can be. No technical mumbo-jumbo to work out. CyberEars.com does all the work for you. You record it, we take care of the rest. So don't delay. Go to CyberEars.com today and register for a free trial account. Upload your audio files and get heard. With CyberEars.com, it's your audio on your terms.
Ah, Jeff Ritzman, another fine day, another fine Paratopia headed our way, eh?
That's right, that's right. It's on its way. Can you feel it?
Can you feel it?
I'm feeling it.
If anyone hears He-Man in the background, that's because He-Man is on in the background. As I said, I'm staying at someone else's place for a month.
Okay.
You may wonder, why would grown people watch He-Man? Do they have children in the room? Well, maybe not. I'm just saying they like to watch He-Man. That's all I'm saying. I'm not making judgments.
Isn't that Skeletor and all that? Isn't that
yes.
What that is? Yeah. Jesus.
Product placement. Yes. So, before we begin, I guess we should address the Phil Imbrogni issue. I guess that's the plural of Imbrogno, right?
Yes.
Okay, good.
I suppose.
Now, I had said, I think on the last show, somewhere I said, maybe give him some time, and then I think I said 2 months, either on the show or on the message board, I don't remember where, but that's turned into a week. I think we've given him plenty of time.
Yeah, yeah.
I have asked him for the name of a professor, I have heard nothing. Somebody showed up on the ATS message board, Bad Boy 666, which while that sounds like it should not be him, all indications are that it very well could be him.
Yeah.
And what that person is saying smacks of what he told me privately, but is not exactly the same, and certainly the reason for his silence is not at all what is written there. Would I be
right in saying that this post on ATS more or less admits that?
The post on ATS is, you know, it's like the oil can Harry bad guy confession, you know.
Right.
And I would have gotten away with it if it wasn't for you meddling kids or something. You know, it's pretty silly stuff, actually. But I just wanted to say that I had emailed him asking him if that was him. And I haven't heard anything back. So sure. I'm going to take the advice of an actual doctor and academic, Dr. Tyler Kochjohn, who says that this man needs to give you something. If he doesn't give you something, then that's it. Because he can. And he hasn't. So that's it.
Yeah, end of story. Yeah. So I guess we should say that thread at ATS... you know, I kind of got into it a little bit with Lance Moody over there. Lance being the guy who I think originally, or one of the original people to come out with this story that they looked into his educational background. And I don't know, I think we got off on a bad foot somewhere for probably the second time, I think. I think it was. But... you know, essentially where we were being accused of being Phil's mouthpiece, so that we were defending him. And that wasn't the case at all. The problem that I had was that Lance earlier in the thread had said, you know, nobody asked him for the information. Nobody came to him for it. And so when I heard that, I kind of took that as an open invitation. And I said, well, I would like to see what you have. Here's my email. Would you send it to me? I would like to look at it. And it was at that point where he said, no, I won't. I've sent it to enough people, and that's the end of it. And then it became pretty much a day long. That makes me suspicious. I mean, when you say you've got data, and then all of a sudden you're not willing to share it with people who ask for it once you more or less offer it. And so I found that suspicious. I mean, that's just my nature. That I mean, we have that in UFO cases as well. Somebody says, I've got this amazing evidence, and yet when you call them and say, I'd like to see that, you never get it. This happens all the time. So the way I put it was, that shit works both ways. And it turned out that Lance essentially, like I said, assumed somehow that we were in cahoots with him and were defending him, and he did not want to turn over any data to somebody who he thought was going to take it back to Phil to use as some kind of ammunition or stall tactic or whatever. And so I can understand that. I wish we'd have come to that understanding early on in the conversation so I could have set him straight. But we ended up speaking in emails privately where I did set him straight on that. And then we talked today on the phone. And, you know, he seems like a decent guy. And we're looking into some other things here. I don't know how much effort we really want to put into it. I think at this point it's kind of a moot issue. It seems to be exactly as Lance has said. It's the credentials are not adding up, and end of story. So
well, and to Lance's defense on that, I'm just thinking this now as you're saying all of this.
Okay.
I don't know why I didn't think of this before, but because here's the thing about Lance Moody. Now, this guy goes on message boards and listens to these shows, and he's a debunker, right? So he always has something negative to say about the paranormal. So it's like, why is a guy like that even listening to this stuff? I mean, is it just to toot his own horn and say, look how smart I am, everyone on a message board, to the point where he gets kicked off those boards? So it's kind of hard to not fall in love with Lance at first glance. However, in his defense, I will say that he was sharing information with another show, and that show then decided to leak the story, and basically they kicked him off their message board for other reasons at around the same time. So, you know, I can see how he would not trust us or trust you based on that experience.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, like I said,
because he was going to keep this quiet. He wasn't going to go public with this, at least not for now. You know,
that's
and then other people jumped the gun completely.
Lance is a skeptic. This is what skeptics do. They dig into this sort of thing. I don't know that I can really fault him. For one, I'm glad that he found this out, and I'm glad we know. However it comes out is how it comes out. I mean, do I think it was unfortunate that it was leaked out the way it was without his input and without his you know, the full battery of knowledge that he had about the situation? Yeah, I think that's extremely unfortunate. But it is what it is. The hows and the whys, I don't care about the personalities. Let's just look at what we've got, and what we've got is extraordinarily problematic. And unfortunately, I've said this before and I'll say it again, Phil isn't the first. He won't be the last. You know, we going forward, if we have a guest that really bolsters credentials, we're going to try and do our best to look into that. But I want our audience to do that too. I want our audience to kind of unintrusively follow up. And maybe if you're that interested in something someone says, you're interested enough to check out their background and try and verify that they are who they claim they are. I mean, we can't do it all. We can't vet every guest. That adds hours and hours to show production.
Yeah, we're not investigators here. We're trying to do a podcast. I mean, this is the unfortunate thing. But I do want to add one thing, because I think I said it on the show again. I can't remember what I said where, but I think I said on the show, Lance Moody, evil blogger who was trying to get Phil Imbrogno. I might have said it on our forum. And that he then had to shut down his blog or something. That was actually a different blogger. There was someone named NYC Jeff, not Jeff Ritzman, obviously, who had a website up, who had written an article called Imbrogno's Imbroglio or something like that.
Okay.
And that was the one that Phil and Rosemary Ellen Guiley were chiming in on in the comments section. And that was about looking into his background. And they were commenting, and then that got taken down. I'm assuming related to them. And that was when I had emailed Phil originally and said, you know, I'm sorry you're going through this. It sucks that someone would do that to you, you know, figuring Phil's on the level, of course. And so when it switched over to Lance Moody, in his email to me, it was all about Lance Moody. He made no mention of that first guy. So I assumed that they were the same person because I didn't really pay attention to who was, you know, writing that originally. I just saw that somebody had and then said, right. Oh, sorry, you're going through this. So I assumed it was all Lance Moody because Moody was the one who was being credited with doing this investigation. And it turns out it was somebody else altogether. So Lance Moody never had anything up on his website. He never had it taken down. I just want to make that distinction if it matters to anybody. I don't know.
I don't know if it's a point or not. I mean, it is what it is. And it's grossly disappointing to me, at least to look at the body of work that Phil did in his time in this. I mean, this is where I ask pretty much every audience member to really take a step back from, you know, the shock and the personality conflicts and the conflict horrors that surrounded all of this and start to really look at what has Phil given to this field and what kind of worth do you place on it at this point in time, knowing what you know. And I mean, for my money, I have to throw it out. Because I know Lee had mentioned something about babies in bathwater, but when you take a piss in the bathtub, nobody wants to get in that tub. So that's pretty much it for me. I've got to kind of put that stuff aside. It's not passing through the filter anymore. So I guess everybody has to make their own choice about that. But that's my feeling. What about you?
Yeah, I agree. I wish there were some way to verify for certain that Bad Boy 666 is Phil. Because
it would be. Yeah, that would be great.
If we could do that, then I could talk about what he wrote to me because it would all be a moot point.
Right.
But since I can't verify that, I mean, I'll give him the same due as I did David Jacobs, which is we never actually read his private email on the air. We just said it's pretty much the same thing that he wrote on his website, you know, however many weeks later.
Right.
That's
not really protecting anybody.
It's my own thing. It's my own. He wrote to me in confidence, so I'm going to keep that confidence until such time as it is 100% proven that's him,
and then it won't matter.
He's giving completely different answers. Yeah.
Right. So anyway, our guest tonight.
Yeah, speaking of trying to find credentials for future guests, we started with this guy, and he said,
"What we did, yeah,
yeah." If anyone wants to, you know, get his credentials from him, he's fine with that.
So yeah, you can go to his website, which is MarianApparitionsAreReal.com. His name is Kevin Cook. And he is considered one of the most foremost authorities on Marian apparitions. And so this is something we haven't really talked about on the show at all, is this spiritual apparitions and all that, right? I mean, this is the first one.
Well, outside of Jacques Vallée, Wonders in the Sky.
Yeah, that touched a little bit on that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I kind of started asking for credentials or proof of education with this guest, and and basically, his masters won't fit in a fax machine to be able to send it. But he said, you know, anybody's welcome to contact him, and he's willing to provide anything you need to vet him as the academic guy that he is. So at any rate, we appreciate that from him. And so are we ready to roll?
Yes, on with the show. And you'll have a different microphone for the show. So in case this microphone completely sucks.
That's right.
Worry not, folks. Worry not.
It's the Turtle Beach gaming headset. I left my mic at work, so.
Ever the professional outfit. He-Man in the background with me. You're on a gaming headset.
I'm on a Halo headset.
let's talk Jesus.
God, here we go.
Paratopia, without further ado, please welcome Kevin Cook. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us on Paratopia to talk about Marian apparitions for the first time on this show.
Well, I'm happy to do it.
Now, I guess probably we should get the boring stuff out of the way, the stuff that you've been asked 8 million times, such as, how did you come into this?
Well, actually, it's not that boring. I've had kind of an X-Files kind of life, more or less. I guess it was a prep for this. I grew up in South Florida, and my father was a big electronics engineer down there, and In essence, he did a lot of volunteer work for the Coast Guard. He hired all the boating instructor courses, boating instructor people for the boating courses for, you know, all the different cities in South Florida. And he hobnobbed with a lot of admirals in doing that. And also, he's a big defense contractor. He owned a major electronics company and did a lot of work for the Defense Department. And I give this as a preface because about that time was when the Bermuda Triangle book came out by Charles Berlitz and all that. And you know, I was a young teenager, and I asked Dad if there's any validity to all these things. And he said, I know you know, expect me to just dismiss it, but no, there actually is. And all kinds of stuff connected with the Bermuda Triangle is as real gets. And that was one issue. And then another issue in my childhood at the same era was there was a movie, The Ghost of Flight 401 with Ernest Borgnine. It was a kind of a classic movie where he was the navigator on an Eastern Airlines flight on a Lockheed L-1011 flight. And it went down in the Glades. And what happened was Eastern Airlines cannibalized the parts from the wreckage and reused them on other L-1011 flights, and every flight they reused the parts on was haunted with the ghost of this navigator. And that was the substance of the movie. And as it turns out, some of our neighbors in Plantation, Florida, a suburb of Fort Lauderdale, were witnesses to the ghost. So, I mean, here at an early age, I got confronted with stuff that was very exotic, yet very valid.
The title of your book, Marian Apparitions Are Real, has an exclamation mark at the end. Is that a nod to flying saucers are real?
Well, not really. It was just a title I liked, and there's been other people that have written similar titles. But I guess when I put it in that in an emphatic sense was to basically, you know, be demonstrative that for my research into it, there's every bit of validity to this phenomenon. As a matter of fact, what I contest is that of all the paranormal field out there, this is the most well-authenticated of any possible paranormal issue.
Well, and when we say well-authenticated, I guess that's sort of the deeper question we'll get into is what exactly has been authenticated. I know the sightings, but is the meaning authenticated? Do we know, can we say for certain that this is what it portends to be?
I think so. To the best of my knowledge, I think so. See, I've run across other issues on different shows and different questions have come up, like, for example, extreme Protestant fundamentalists would say, it's of the devil. Well, no, it isn't. That's ridiculous. Anybody who's familiar with Catholicism knows that we don't, you know, worship Mary as such, as a goddess or anything. She's not trying to go into business for herself. And also, you know, as far as those that would say UFO content to it, I don't buy that because there's no real evidence of that either.
Well, have you read Jacques Vallée's Wonders in the Sky by any chance?
I've read some little excerpts from Jacques Vallée over the years, but not that particular book. No.
Because that's his most recent. He has a catalog of just things seen in the sky from antiquity on up, and he ends it when flight begins. So it's really interesting. And so a lot of it is, you know, warriors in the field seeing battles of humans playing out in the sky. And then somewhere along the way, that sort of gives way to these Marian apparitions. I mean, you could make the case that there are things that are seen in the sky, and then as culture grows, you know, it gives way to things sort of coming down and speaking to people.
Yeah.
And then once we end up actually taking to the sky in airplanes and the such, then it goes right back to things in the sky again. It sort of resets itself, except this time the things in the sky are
discs. I think that's
discs.
Really kind of speculative, really, because you got to understand, this has been going on for 2,000 years, and most of the sightings are not necessarily in the sky or anything. They're very one-on-one kind of associations. And there's been as many as 14 million people that have seen one particular sighting.
Well, let's get into what was the one that really appealed to you, and you said you connected with it and said, okay, there's got to be something to this. I've got to investigate this.
Well, it kind of culminated in September of 2008. What I did was I have an upstate New York fascination, and I was looking for some property up there, pretty reasonably priced. And, you know, I looked at the property, spent a few days playing tourist, and the night before I was going to, or really a day and a half before I was going to fly out back home to Texas, I stopped over in Fultonville. It's a little town near Albany, about 40 miles westbound of Albany on Highway 90. And I said, well, I'll just set aside, you know, that next day, Wednesday, just to, you know, sightsee in the Mohawk Valley. And what happened was I ran across Our Lady of Martyrs Shrine in Orrysville, New York, within, you know, just a few minutes. And what I experienced there was very awesome. I was there about an hour and a half, and for the first 45 minutes, I smelled an overpowering, you know, wrenching smell of roses, and there weren't any roses except maybe 20 acres away. You know, I mean, you know, not even a bloodhound could have smelled them. And finally, after experiencing this for such a long time, I went in and talked to the curator of the museum there, and I said, look, lady, I sell trees and plants for a living. All I see is pines, maples, this sort of thing, nothing very fragrant. And she said, you smelled it too? And I said, yeah, I did, I guess. And she even showed me on the grounds of the shrine, it's about 80-acre plateau, where, in all likelihood, I smelled the smell in the strongest sense. And that was where the first rosary was said in that part of the country in 1642. That's a series of Catholic prayers connected with the Virgin Mary. And what it was, this is such an awesome experience, because I've been me long enough to know when something unique happens, you know. And I don't have a great sense of smell. I take Zyrtec and all that stuff. And just because I was in New York a couple of days didn't make me cured from the allergies necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew I'd experience something quite dramatic. And as it turns out, I did some research into it, and that's an experience which is replicated hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times at Catholic shrines and connected with Catholic saints. It's called the odor of sanctity. And that was such a moving experience that, of course, I already had a pre-existing interest in Marian apparitions, and upon looking into them, I found this odor of sanctity was part and parcel of many of the Marian apparition experiences.
To what end, do you know?
I'm sorry?
Do you know to what end? What's the point of having a phantom smell like that? Do you know?
To be candid with you, I don't. I'm the expert at it, and I can't really say. But it just seems to be a phenomenon that's associated with Catholic saints. Padre Pio was a saint that died in the 60s, and he was a well-studied individual and so forth and so on. A lot of paranormal phenomena happened around him, and one of them was the odor of sanctity that kind of followed him around wherever he was, and there was no cologne or no pedestrian explanation. So I guess what I'm saying is, you know, it was got getting smacked in the face with a tuna. I mean, this stuff exists. It's not superstition. It's not silliness. It's a very valid experience.
Okay, so as far as the actual visions themselves, is this something that you have personally experienced?
No, unfortunately, I haven't, no. Like I said, I got led into it with my experiences I've had that were kind of on the periphery of it. But I did do about a year and a half of research into it, and I don't know if you've seen on the website or anywhere a copy of the book where some of the pictures that are in it, like they're on the website?
Yes.
Well, if you saw that picture over that domed church in Cairo, Zaytun, Egypt, Zaytun's a suburb of Cairo, that was seen in the 68 through 1970 period by up to 14 million people on Arab television in Egypt, and millions saw it in person, too. This is a silent apparition as opposed to one where she speaks to the individual seer, witnesses or seers, what they call them. But it was had Vatican observers, Time magazine was there, the New York Times, Paris Match, the German magazine Stern. I mean, there's reporters all through this. And that was the most dramatic of sightings, even though it didn't have some of the other spicy elements to it, like cures and prophecies and all that other stuff.
Well, where in the Catholic Church is there room for cures and prophecies and all of that? I mean, I thought this was all sort of false idol stuff.
No, it isn't. There's been Well, no, I mean, I don't see that has anything to do with false idol stuff at all, really. I mean, there's been all through history, there's been visions of angels and messengers and such, and it talked of men prophesying in later times in the Bible. This is nothing that's unique as opposed to the biblical times. And really, it makes sense because, you know, this is a spiritual world. There's a devil, there's angels, there's the whole nine yards. It's not like everybody went in the closet to, you know, and hiding over all these many years. See?
Well, has there been a sort of a cohesive message throughout the years, or has there been an evolving message? What sort of message is there when these
the
things
happen?
The
message is, to an extent, consistent in that it's more or less what you might term preachy, what you'd expect a maternal form of message as far as believing in Jesus as her son and adhering to prayer and being good to each other and all this kind of classical Christian type of message you'd expect. But there have been prophetic messages which have spoken of some pretty dramatic things, like she appears frequently at very pivotal moments in time. I could get into some of them with you, but a lot of what she says at a given pivotal moment in time is very, very impressive and adds a lot to the authenticity of the experience.
Well, sure. Why don't we get into that?
Well, one of the most powerful appearances was in 1531. You're probably familiar with this thing on the back of, say, Mexican Americans. A lot of them have the Our Lady of Guadalupe in the back of their truck. You know,
right.
Well, that is a image that appeared on a cactus husk garment. An Indian Catholic convert named Juan Diego was walking in the area of a Tepeyac Hill, which is more or less the present site of Mexico City. Okay. And the Virgin Mary appeared to this Indian, and she said for him to go to the bishop and to tell the bishop that, you know, she wanted a chapel built in that hill area. And, you know, he did this, trying to comply with her desires. And the bishop basically patted this guy on the head and said, well, thank you, buddy. I'm glad you talked to the Virgin Mary. You're a kook. And come back when you've got some proof, and that'll be that. And which is, you know, kind of what you could expect. And he went, he saw her again, and she placed in his tilma, this cactus husk cloak is what it really is, a bunch of Castilian roses. And remember, this was December in Mexico City. It's high elevation. It's pretty cold. It's not any place where there's roses growing. And 1531, there's no way you could speed them on over from Castile or anything. And he presented them to the bishop as a proof of her apparitional experience. And when he opened the cloak to present the roses, this image was on the back of this tulma, this cactus husk garment. That is the symbol of Our Lady of Guadalupe. And more than that, I know for a fact that engineers from Sandia Labs have taken fragments from that garment, which is on display to this day in the Basilica of Guadalupe in Mexico City, and there's no evidence of tracing, and there's no pigment. This has been examined more than the Shroud of Turin, more than any other artifacts you could come up with.
Why do you think something like that is necessary?
Because I think it's very necessary because people's faith is strained. They had miracles in the Bible.
But isn't that the point of faith? Isn't the point of faith that it's faith?
Yeah, right. But, I mean, that's why Jesus was coming up with miracles every 5 minutes, and that was obviously to give people the inclination that this is the real deal. So I think, obviously, that people need a reminder. I know I did. I found it very helpful.
Why do you think it's Mary in visions and not Jesus visions?
Actually, the book says visits of Jesus and Mary. Jesus shows up in many of these apparitional events.
Hmm. And when he shows up, is there a clear delineation in roles, or how does that work? Do they, if they show up together, is she a mother to him? Is he like, what's that sort of relationship in the vision?
They basically don't show up at the same interval, but. Oh, I see. There's basically it's a relatively limited role, but I mean it's more or less a powerful message that, you know, to do one thing or another as far as like, for example, he showed up at the apparitional event in Rwanda there's a book, Our Lady of Cabejo, that's out on the market, and that dealt with an approved apparition by the church in Rwanda in the 1990s, and others. And basically, the messages that come through in these events are pretty classical, what you could expect. There's nothing that's anti-biblical or anti-Christian in message, nothing offbeat. Except when there have been some demonically inspired apparitions, but very few. Very few.
How does one tell the difference?
Well, the one in Bayside, New York, was coming up with all kinds of kooky, offbeat pronouncements that weren't very Christian, and there was actually a bunch of weird kind of poltergeisty activity around the place, and there actually turned to be some exorcisms connected with that at apparitional event. But like I say, that's extremely rare.
And what was the first Marian apparition that you can trace back?
The first recorded Marian apparition is Our Lady of the Pillar that happened in Sargasso, Spain in 41 AD. And that's where the Virgin Mary was still living. And she appeared to the Apostle James, who was evangelizing the Spaniards in that area and having a tough time doing it. Basically, she appeared to him to buoy him up and, basically keep, tell him to keep going and not be discouraged.
Would it bother you if this turned out not to be what it appears to be?
Sure, but I'm convinced more than I need to be that it's just fine. I don't have any problems like that.
What convinces you of that?
Well, the reason I wrote the book is I was impressed with the length and breadth of the evidence. Like that shroud of, not the shroud of Brother, but the image on that tilma I talked to you about, and the number of witnesses and the millions, something that's been reported for 2,000 years, prophecy that's turned out exactly right. And I must also say, you don't have to believe in Marian apparitions or their validity to be a Christian or a Catholic either. It's not required. But I feel very certain that it's valid as all get up.
Is there any one that stands out to you as sort of the incontrovertibly, sort of this is it, you can't deny this, in terms of not just physical evidence, but even, say, prophecy? I mean, is there one that has all of the elements that you would want?
Well, the physical evidence is really unparalleled in the Guadalupe one. The prophecies that were found in Our Lady of Fatima, where she appeared to three young children in Portugal, and that she, these were basically semi-literate children, agrarian children, and she described them about Russia in 1917, and she described to Sister Lucia, who was the primary seer, that, Russia would, have errors that would cause disruption in the world. It's basically a precursor to the rise of communism and the Russian Revolution. And these children knew nothing of Russia. They couldn't find it on a map if you held a gun to their head. And all these things were well recorded at the time by the local, people in that area and reporters and everything else. I mean, it wasn't like this was made up in whole cloth thereafter or anything like that. And in essence, that plus some prophecies connected with a second and greater war, because they were in the First World War at that time, and she indicated there'd be another second war, which was an allusion to World War II, and just quite a few things were very incontrovertible. Also, it came to a culminating point in October of 1917, where they had a prophesized miracle, because people were asking for a genuine card-carrying miracle, and that was where they had the Dance of the Sun. They had 100,000 people in a plane called the Cova de Ira, and it was raining like mad, and they were waiting overnight for this apparitional event. A lot of the crowd was made up of components of people trying to debunk the apparition, actually, because the government in Portugal was a socialist government, which was basically anti-clerical and was trying to, basically brand the church as being preservers of the status quo, the rich elite and the poor peasants, blah, blah, like that.
And well, what do you do with the fact that people reported different things? I mean, some people reported what you could say are, UFO activity.
No.
No? What do you mean, no? Yeah, they did. What are you talking about, no?
No, they didn't either. The Dance of the Sun, as far as celestial things, they didn't have, like, a ship, like a flying saucer, and any accounts I've read.
Well, wait a minute. You must have read accounts of people seeing different things that day. Not some people saw
they
the sun, some
them
people...
differently, but nothing in the classical UFO sense, no.
Huh.
Do you want me to break off the interview right now? Because I'm telling you the truth, and I'm not going to have any cynicism from some guy who doesn't know what he's talking about.
I don't really want you to break off the interview now, but I think that there might be some deeper issues involved seems like you might not be open to.
I don't think it's a demonic thing, if that's what you're trying to do, and I've studied it.
No. I don't know about demonic.
I mean, my book is on the bibliography of the International Marriott Research Institute. I'm considered probably the top expert or one of the top experts in the world on this, and I'm not going to be made fun of.
No, I'm not making fun of you.
No, I don't say fine,
but I'm not going to have a lot of snide nonsense from somebody that's never really busted a gun.
Kevin, I think what this is stemming from is Fatima. In many cases that I've read, and I've been in this 25 years, a lot of it very much smells like a UFO sighting. In fact, you know, when you're talking about a disc covering the sun or a disc the size of the sun, something like that.
In a globe of light and La Salette. But it basically what I have read is basically the sun seemed to dance in the sun of what they call it, like it acted in erratic form. But there's also so many other facets to this that were separate, distinct from whatever celestial displays. These people just tried to explain it in the best way they could.
Sure.
And, I mean, they didn't know what airplanes were. So what I'm saying, or very little, and so what I'm saying is the only reason I think, in my opinion, which is just an opinion, that people grasp onto this UFO thing, like George Norrie so strongly, is because it's easier for them to relate to UFOs, to believe in UFOs than something that would be divine, because it's just more comfortable to them psychologically.
Well, it's non-denominational.
It's not threatening either. If God's
reaching out
to somebody, I mean, everybody with any brains would believe that there's UFOs because it's been too much smoke to not have some fire in there somewhere.
Absolutely.
Over many years. I go to UFO conferences. It interests me. But what I'm saying is, I think there's validity to it. But no, I don't think. You have a 2,000-year-old phenomena with all kinds of fascinating and very intricate interrelations with the Virgin Mary, and one potential description that may or may not be a UFO is not going to deter the whole phenomena from having validity.
No, I don't think it would either.
Talking hundreds and hundreds, probably it's been estimated as many as 2,500, 2,700 apparitions.
No, the thing that I was balking at is that I couldn't understand that you haven't heard that explanation
before. I'm familiar with it, but the descriptions are so vague and hazy, you could be talking about a lot of things. You'd be talking about ball lightning, for goodness sakes. But, I mean, nothing that was the classical, yes, there's a disc in the sky, like, the guy in 1947 or whatever, no, what was it? George Adamski or something like that.
Oh, no, nothing like that, no. No, I'm not in the class.
What I'm getting at is, you know, it's a very vague description. Mm-hmm. But people fasten on that like with both claws, and they're ignoring 99.999% of the experiences in this phenomenon. That's what I'm saying.
Well, at Fatima, I mean, let me just ask, what is the classical description from start to finish that you've been able to kind of either piece together from a bunch or
the witnesses' classical descriptions has been. The sun seemed to dance in the sky. It even seemed to be coming down towards the populace there.
Okay.
And they were scared because they didn't know obviously something bizarre was happening and they didn't know what was up. Mm-hmm. That is basically the nuts and bolts of the description that's been ascribed to it. Mm-hmm. But also some other things. The prophecies had nothing to do with a bunch of aliens. Mm-hmm. Okay. all the cures that were associated with it that were alleged to have come from that experience had nothing to do with aliens. Mm. Also, the people were soaking wet on this plane, 100,000 people, and they were all of a sudden miraculously dry. Mm. That's a phenomenon that's well attested to. Also, interestingly, of the dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of very skeptical reporters that were set there to debunk it,
nobody really debunked it. None.
And this happened over. This has happened because you're talking to somebody who's completely unfamiliar with most Marian apparition stuff. But yeah. Was Fatima many days or one day?
It was a monthly experience over about a 12 or 13 month period. Yeah.
Okay. And the sun dancing in the sky, all of that happened on a monthly basis?
Well, no. It kind of culminated. Most of these were
It culminated with that.
Yeah, okay. I mean, they had asked, the people had been asking for and had relayed to the seers, asked the Virgin Mary for a sign, like they always do.
Right.
And that was promised that on this day there would be this issue, and that was, you know, celestial displays, whatever it was, and that's what happened.
Now let me ask you this, because this is a really curious thing for me, because in a way this kind of fits in with other paranormal things that I've heard, if you want to classify this as paranormal, which I do, in the sense of the people watching at Fatima, all these people gathered together, they see this unbelievable thing occur.
Yeah.
Was this, I mean, it would stand to reason that people perhaps hundreds of miles away would have seen something in that direction. Were in surrounding areas, did people report anything in those vast surrounding areas around that area?
To the best of my knowledge, no.
See, that's interesting. That's really interesting to me, because
remember, this is a very rural area too.
Sure. But when you're talking about the sun dancing around in the sky, you know, one would immediately think,
oh, I know what you're saying. I know, but as a matter of fact, it seemed to be very localized. Now, also, you're saying about one of the things that's been seen, one of the prophecies that was very intriguing that Mary relayed to his children was the Second World War that was alluded to would be immediately preceded by a great light being seen in the sky in Europe. And they had just before, Hitler was at his Berchtesgaden retreat, and there was a tremendous, unbelievable, unprecedented display of the Aurora Borealis in the late 30s. And Hitler saw this and recognized this as the sign that now that we can begin, or if you will. And this was basically what's the kickoff was to World War II. And this was prophesied to Sister Lucia in the messages that were given to her.
Huh. Now,
this
as far
an
as
unprecedented example of the Aurora Borealis, much, and that was seen all over Europe. But anyway,
yeah.
As far as the dancing in the sky and the sun in the sky, no.
That was a very localized thing.
Yeah, and that same phenomenon in a lesser degree was experienced at Batania in the 1990s, late 80s, early 90s. They had a series of apparitions in Venezuela, and they've had similar celestial displays, and they had similar celestial displays in Rwanda in the 1990s as well. So it's, in other words, this has been repeated several times. But
yeah,
in all these various instances, it's never been like this, the typical UFO or anything like that, no.
Right. I mean, the thing that really interests me about it is that a lot of UFO sightings that are, if you want to call them mass, or even if they're just individual or a small group of people, four or five, you kind of get that same localized, almost tunneled vision of them, stepping to one side or the other. I mean, as much as three steps, which I've seen myself, the thing is not there, and then you step three steps back, and there it is again. It's this very, it's here for you. This is for you and you only.
Right.
Very personalized type of experience, which I think is interesting, especially when you're talking about thousands of people.
I know. Yes, I know, and that's very good point. It is, you know, quite striking, and, you know, there is a lot of disparity in all these Marian apparitions. I mean, some are to one individual, like Bernadette.
Right.
Lourdes, and some are, like that one I just mentioned about Zaytun, Egypt, is, was in front of 14 million people, in essence, I mean, over a protracted two-year period.
Right. Well, so, I wanted to ask you about that one, the photograph that's on your homepage.
Yeah,
that's the one on the right for listeners kind of following along here. I mean, is there video of that anywhere? Is there actual motion footage of that any place, or is it just stills that we have?
Off Arab television.
Hmm.
And it was there's no copyrights on it at this point because it was so old and also so well distributed.
And what year was this? I'm sorry.
It was over. This happened 3 to 5 times a week. in front of St. Mark's Coptic Church in Zeitoun, Egypt, suburb of Cairo, from 1968 through 1970. And it had another spate of similar apparitions in another suburb, Warik El Hadar, in Cairo, that happened in fall of 2009.
So there should, by all rights, there should be motion footage of this somewhere.
There's YouTube on the one from 2009 on the, or was on YouTube.
Okay.
Yeah.
But as far as the one from Cairo?
Yes.
It's out there. I mean, did that apparition, did it move at all?
Yes.
I mean, it does appear to be free floating. And,
yes,
and I mean, I'm looking at a still on a website, so it's hard to tell what's actually going on. But, you know, it looks like you've...
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. It looks like you've definitely got reflected light on the dome behind her. So she looks like she's probably halfway to three quarters of the way down the edge of that slope because there's an enormous amount of light underneath the figure and behind it to its right, not so much to its left. You know, which leads me to think that it's something physical that's there that's casting this indirect light, especially on the, I guess that's an... either a cross or an eagle above that's on the spire. I mean, that's very well lit up and appears to be free floating. So
there's a corollary to that I was going to tell you about. Is that
sure.
At the time, you got at the 1968, they had another strong man in power at that time. His name was Nasser, and he's basically a client of the Soviets, you know, their man in Egypt. And what it was he was a Muslim in name only, you know, not really, just kind of had to be president, but not a real practicing Muslim. And certainly wasn't a Christian. He wouldn't emphasize anything that would, you know, endorse Christianity. All right. That said, Nasser sent Egyptian special forces troops block by block, door by door, a mile square around that church in Cairo to see if there's any kind of chicanery or, you know, holographic projection or anything like that, found nothing. At the end of his investigation, even this Nasser, the president of the country, said it was a valid and true experience from a Muslim. Now, I think that's pretty dramatic itself.
Yeah. I mean, certainly, I'm not – I mean, I did stage production for – a number of years. I mean, I could say it's a scrim, but where in the hell would you put it? Where would you hang the scrim? I don't see any way that you're going to put them up there and actually have that.
This was interactive with the crowd.
Oh, so what did it do? I mean, it was non-speaking, you said, right?
If someone, you know, screamed out to them, they would wave at them periodically. Or at least acknowledge it with a, you know, nod of the head or something like that. I mean, in other words, it wasn't just a flat, static figure, no.
Right. Did this have any – I mean, you can't really tell from this photograph here, but did it have any facial features and folds in clothing or anything
some
like that?
Some of the write-ups I've read have said at different times you could discern the feminine features in her face more readily and so forth.
Huh. What about the picture to the left on your homepage? Where is that?
Okay, now that was – okay, now is that of a woman on a hill?
It looks like the top of a pine tree. And
oh, yes. Okay, yeah. That was taken in Medjugorje. Of course, they've had apparitional sightings there for 30 years that the church is investigating now with its own commission to determine the validity of it.
Okay.
But what happened was the church I go to, one of the ladies knew I was writing a book about Marian apparitions. And she says, I've got something for you. And her companion, she and this companion had gone on a pilgrimage to Medjugorje, several of them. And one of the ones she went on, this woman took a picture of that hill. It's Mount Podpro, I think they call it.
Okay.
And what it amounts to is that image was what was on the film after the film was developed. And they say, well, I'm crazy. Well, that's what she said.
Huh.
And nobody's making any money out of it. And if you've written any books, you know that you don't make any much money anyway.
Right.
But what I'm saying is this is in this woman's office. She works for the church itself. She's works in the liturgy. And her husband's a Catholic deacon. In other words, salt of the earth type people. And like I say, I quizzed them very strongly on the validity of the picture. And it is. I mean, nobody's making any dough of this. It just is a really bizarre picture.
Yeah.
And that image of Mary was not on the... All they did was originally was take a picture of the hill where the apparition supposedly occurred initially. And right. There's no good reason why that would be on the film.
Huh. I was just going to say, by all rights to me, that looks like... I mean, if you asked me just straight off the cuff at first blush, no, it looks like a standard double exposure of a statue.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I appreciate what you're saying.
You know,
and like I say, I didn't have, you know, electric cattle prods to use on
yeah.
or anything.
Yeah.
But also, once again, the thing about back to the Cairo one,
mm-hmm.
They had Vatican observers there. They had observers from the Egyptian Coptic Church, which is where the vision occurred over. That's an Eastern Orthodox version of Catholicism in Egypt, long-standing, old, ancient denomination. At any rate, all kinds of church officials and every other guy walking around trying to debunk it, nobody could. Even the president couldn't. And, this is Egypt 1968. They didn't have holographic projection equipment. I mean, we might have it now, but just barely. And they certainly did it in that backwater place, you know, almost 50 years ago. So, what I'm getting at, guys, is I know healthy skepticism is important, and I understand that.
Sure.
But there comes a time when, you know, you got to understand a little bit about me, too. I'm an ex-Army sergeant. I'm an old-line salesman. I'm just a hard, muscle-bound old buzzard, okay?
Okay.
I'm a martial artist. I mean, I'm just a hard guy. I've been in knife fights, brawls. I'm just not the average guy. And if something affected me so strongly, like in New York, believe me, it happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm saying,
yeah. I mean, there's no. Yeah, I'm sorry. There's no questioning that experiences like this have got to be extraordinarily powerful. You know, the thing that. I'm curious about and see my own. I mean, you're obviously a man who are you Catholic? Is that did I understand
yeah.
that right? So, I mean, I grew up a Roman Catholic, and I be honest with you, I don't really go to church anymore. I see a kind of a larger picture of religion and God that kind of speaks to me in a different way these days. In so much as that, I don't know, religion to a point seems, this would be a given, too small to really describe the nature of what God in reality and its interaction with us is. And so I'm, you know, I kind of go that direction these days. So I'm, but I see these tangents that kind of run through paranormal stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, we were talking about Fatima and the connection with UFO stuff. And I mean, certainly when you tear it down to bare bones, an unknown object in the sky doing crazy maneuvers could be considered ufologically related. But
right.
Something like this thing in Egypt that is like a haloed figure at times that seems to have feminine features to it and all of that. Mm-hmm. I haven't looked that far into it, so I can't really speak on any authority image-wise. But what was going on in Egypt during that period? Was this a really turbulent time there? Was it a time of upheaval?
It was. Remember, there was the 1967 Israeli-Egypt war
mm-hmm.
That just had just ended and, you know, could have broken out again any minute.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a pivotal timing to her showing up, and, you know, it could be... You know, it could be alleged that the likelihood, you know, this is here again, the subjective, but the likelihood of her showing up was kind of, you know, because understand, too, this episode completely enthralled the whole country of Egypt. I mean,
right.
For 2 years, we're talking as many as 250,000 people were in that square 3 to 5 times a week
uh-huh.
for 2 years. That's all anybody talked about.
Sure.
So what I'm saying is the whole country's focus was on Mary and religious miracles and not let's go kill the Jews kind of thing.
Right. Yeah.
And, but see, I guess I didn't mean to lose my mind on you a minute ago, but what I'm getting at is even Nori and I, George Nori and I go round and round about this, about the coast to coast guy about, you know, well, at La Salette, she showed up in a globe of light. It could have been a UFO. Well, listen, I mean, how do you know how the Virgin Mary shows up?
Hey, Kevin, let me tell you something. This is a guy who asked Jacques Vallée. Jacques, could they have been angels?
In fact, I find this ironic because I actually got kicked off Nori's show when I told him about a UFO I saw, and he asked me if it could have been angelic, and I thought he was kidding. So I'm shocked that he goes the other way with you. That's weird.
Well, I like George, and I'll probably be back on the show. I don't want to say anything and make him mad, and I owe George a lot, but... And this was one instance. I guess what I'm trying to say is not to knock George, because I love George. But what I'm trying to say is you got to look at the depth and the richness of this experience and this whole study. I mean, to just fasten on the Fatima aerial displays is just the smallest part of it. See?
Mm-hmm.
Like a whole tapestry of stuff with the prophecies, the timing, the phenomenal number of witnesses, miracle cures just out the wazoo. I mean, we're talking about real smoke and fire here.
Can I ask you, do you know how the Catholic Church goes about authenticating, like you said, Metagorgy? They're still working on it. What do they do? What's their process?
Okay, the process, like and everything else they do, is incredibly laborious and tedious. What they do, like in most investigations, they interview the witnesses and look into their backgrounds as far as whether they have, you know, they're habitual liars or they're credible people or subject to mental disorder, you know, to determine, you know, where they're coming from. And they, not just the initial witnesses, but any tangential witnesses around, what did you see? Did you see this, you know, any physical evidence? In other words, they have a very long-standing commission. A bishop will set up a commission that'll really get down to brass tacks about what happened, and they'll get testimony from anybody that could even come close to having anything to add. And, of course, they chronicle whatever was said and written down, like any prophecies, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a very laborious process. And the first level of acceptance would be, before a determination is made, is it worthy of, that they could determine it's worthy of devotional expression. In other words, if you want to make a pilgrimage to this area, you can. We're not, you know, exactly buying into it, but still you can. And the second and more complete designation would be that it's of supernatural nature. In other words, Mary really came. This is a real deal. The evidence is irrefutable as best could be determined. In the back of my book is an index I got from the Marian Research Institute and the University of Dayton. It delineates Marian apparitions from the year 1900 to the present day, a little over 110 years. And in most of them, there is no determination made as far as whether they're valid or invalid, just a very handful. And that's pretty well the way it is throughout. I mean, but you see, most investigations are that way anyway. I mean, I've heard jokes about the FBI. They couldn't find people if they were in a phone booth with them. I mean, you know. In other words, if they're going to make a determination, it has to be pretty strong and hard, yes.
What would someone from the church have to witness something firsthand, do you think? Would that be the end-all, be-all of,
that
guys, this is legit?
That would be a great thing, but in most of these, that has not been the case. Most of the
has not happened. Okay.
In very rare cases, it's been mostly at Sears. Frankly, a lot of them are agrarian peasant women in France.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, the Egypt apparition, I mean, that was obviously seen by somebody from the Vatican or somebody.
Yeah. The Coptic Church and reporters just crawling all over the place.
And, yeah. And they said that was definitely something legit.
Nothing has ever. And I've looked for this because, you know, I'm not going to stand behind something I feel is wishy-washy and not put 2 years of my life into writing a book if I think it's a bunch of baloney. And I never found not one negative. Oh, that's a bunch of malarkey. No, I never did. Like I say, even as President Nasser came out and endorsed it. And, you know, that's pretty hard to do in a Muslim country, you know. I mean, but it happened.
Has there ever been any Marian apparitions, in your opinion, that after you've read about them in depth, have you seen any that are so strong a story? And then towards maybe the end or maybe some tangential description, there is an aspect of it that almost seems to, I don't know, dethrone itself or to negate itself in some way, or does that play in here at all?
There have been some, and I don't want to talk out of turn because I don't know everything about Medjugorje because not all of it's been left out for investigation, examination. But one of the problems in Medjugorje is the 30-year duration of the apparitions, and also different people, different times, and there is a potentiality, and I'm not saying it's true or not. I mean, it's not my call. But, I mean, there's been some people, like the local bishop, who said some negative things about, you know, he doesn't buy into it or whatever. Uh-huh. And that's why the church has formed a commission with this Cardinal Ruini to come to grips with the reality of it. But that may be one where it was initially true and the later apparitions were not. I'm just speculating now. I mean, I can't say much more than that. But the Bayside New York one, which is pretty well gone down as the number one exorcist-ridden demonic apparition. And also, it's interesting. I was on a show, you may have heard of it, New England Ghosts, up there in Providence, Rhode Island, Paul Eno, Behind the Paranormal with Paul and Ben Eno.
Okay.
And we talked about that event in Bayside, New York, and Paul was actually knew the Warrens, who were exorcists and also Catholics, and they were aware of demonic connection with it. But that is an apparition that initially looked squared away and then started going loose around the edges pretty quickly. Huh. And there's been others. There's to an extent that I don't know this for a fact here once again either, but the one in Conyers in the 1990s, early 1990s, I think that that has had some negative aspects connected with it, or said to have.
What do you where do I start here with this? Our Lady of Guadalupe.
Yeah.
I'm looking at a really nice big scan of this image.
Yeah.
And the caption underneath of it says, "Our picture of Our Lady of Guadalupe, not painted by any human hand." Can you explain that a little bit? How is that determined?
Yeah, remember when I said that it had been examined by Sandia Labs engineers, and it had. Mm-hmm. To find evidence of tracing or pigment, and they couldn't find either one. And not only that, there's another little twist to this that's pretty unique. Is okay, they've had 20 different ophthalmologists examine the Virgin Mary's eyes in this image.
Okay.
When you and I look at each other, our eyes have curved lenses, and they form a distortion effect called the Sampson-Purkinje effect, which is basically just a distorted image in a lens, okay, caused by a curve, okay. The Virgin Mary's eyes show three people standing in front of her with the same Sampson-Purkinje effect. 20 different ophthalmologists have examined this element, just her eyes. It's been looked under microscopes.
Okay.
And it replicates what a human's eye would reflect. In other words, what I'm saying is this is beyond what an artist can replicate. I guarantee you in the 1500s they wouldn't know any more about the Sampson-Purkinje effect than they'd know about, you know, Craig computers.
So we're talking about anatomical nature of the human eye is what you're saying, right?
Yes.
And if there's no pigment in this, what is making up the color?
I don't know. I mean, that's a good question. That's what makes the mystery to it. But
what material is this on? I'm sorry.
It's cactus husk.
Cactus husk.
Yeah, just basically woven cactus husk.
Because if they're looking at this underneath a microscope and they're not seeing pigment, they're just seeing cactus husk that is colored.
Right.
There is no pigment on top of the husk. Am I correct?
Pigment just lays like a coating on the surface, right?
Correct. Okay, so
I know it's hard to grasp, but I'll buy that. But I mean, I've read so much research on it; it's well available.
Mm-hmm.
It's very dramatic.
Is there no? Have they found any sort of strokes at all? Is there any? I mean, I'm looking at it and I'm seeing more or less like a, I guess, it's a halo around her. kind of looks like the inside of a mollusk shell, like a seashell type pattern around her.
The only summary I can have of it is they found no evidence of a tracing, like, you know, all artists will make a little tracing and then put it in. And there's no element of pigment. Now, as far as any brush strokes, I'm not familiar with any. No. I mean, I don't really know how this garment got to be the way it is.
Yeah.
And also, another side kicker to it is, consider what it's made of is very fragile material.
Yeah.
And it's in pristine condition. It's only been under glass for the last 150 years. It's been subject to heat, cold, moisture, even terrorist activity in 1920. Somebody tried to blow it up.
Right.
And it's in pristine condition. Now, that's pretty remarkable if it was just regularly painted.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, what I'm saying is that's what I said to preface this, that some of the evidence is so strong in this and so well studied that a guy that wrote the recommendation for the book, Dr. Tim Barth, he's head of the psychology department at TCU, he's a Catholic ghost hunter, just a big academic, all that.
Okay.
He is amazed at the level of evidence that there is in Marian apparitions compared with other areas of the paranormal, because, like I say, he dabbles in ghost hunting and this and that. But he's amazed at this level of stuff, like the study of this garment, compared with people, you know, oohing and eyeing over an orb, which could be, you know, a little speck of light or,
yeah.
I mean, you know,
at least you got something. You got something in hand here. I mean, that's a little different. You got something to look at. Yeah.
Yeah. And, anyway, he, and of course all the whole other dimensions of it, the prophecies, the cures, the this, the that, that uncommon, unnatural knowledge, like that girl Sister Lucia would have about the Russian Revolution. What, you know, this kid don't even know where Russia is. I mean, probably couldn't spell Russia, I mean, let alone Russia and its errors. And she certainly wouldn't know about the Aurora Borealis and anything else living in Portugal. So, some of these things are really quite striking and very well authenticated and, you know, chronicled at the time.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of things that are really well preserved, aside from this cactus husk, St. Bernadette.
I know. In the book. I know. She's actually my patron saint.
We're going to put a photograph probably up on our message board of St. Bernadette, born 1844, died 1879. I saw this on television not horribly long ago. There was a program, and I want to say it was Sci-Fi Channel, but for some reason I'm thinking that's wrong. It's probably History Channel.
Yeah.
They had a – pardon my memory. I can't remember the name of the show.
Well,
devastating the cute host. I remember that. She was a real looker, but I don't remember what the name of the show was. But
was the term what they called her, the Incorruptibles?
I think so. I mean, she went to where St. Bernadette is laid out in her gold and class coffin and all that, and looked at her, and they had her on video for a very long time, and you were able to really look at just about every angle of her face, and it's ridiculous.
And also understand, she was dug up about 15 years after she died.
Right.
And then she was dug up yet again. Her body's flexible. There's a book that was written called The Incorruptibles by Joanne Cruz.
Mm-hmm.
It came out in 1977. It's still in print. And she chronicles 103 different examples of where bodies just did not decay in the normal sense.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Bernadette has a little wax on her face. It's not a wax mask, just a little wax because of discoloration, but that's it.
Right.
I mean, she has not rotted.
No, she got makeup on, apparently. I mean, that's really all it boils down to is makeup.
Yeah, I mean, as far as just rotting like an old skull there, it hasn't happened. And she's not been embalmed. And there's others. Joanne Cruz's book makes good reading. There's others. There's a Russian Orthodox monk named Marmaluf or something like that. And his body was actually partially underwater, and he did not deteriorate.
Right.
I mean, which is really remarkable stuff.
Well, they did say something in that program about that something within the earth in that particular area acts as some kind of preserving agent. But when you see other examples of that preserving agent that they were showing, And even when they're talking about Saint Bernadette, there was something in there about the ground that she was interred in was – there was something unique about it. But even still, I can't imagine. I mean, even when you look at the some of the
ones like this.
Yeah. I mean, when you look at some of these things that like there's a I think it's called the Wax Man or the Soap Man. I can't remember what it is, but he's in the Mutter Museum, I think. And there's a guy that I forget how many years old that he is, but he is essentially made of soap. The ground that he was interred in was was impregnated
with a
chemical reaction happens with the body.
Yeah, I understand.
You look at Saint Bernadette; it ain't happening that way. No, I mean, I'm sorry. She's laying in this thing, and this woman looks like she was laid down last night.
I know. They take more pictures of her because she's prettier anyway. But what it is?
Yeah,
is,
she's a good-looking girl. Yeah.
But there's 103 different examples of this and in different parts of the world. And why isn't old Louis the rapist, why isn't he untrappable if it's just a matter of elements in the earth, you know?
Right.
Of course, you know, say we didn't dig him up. Well, maybe so. But there's lots of people under the in Paris, underground Paris, where there's skulls piled up on skulls that deteriorated just fine. And in other words, I don't know. I mean, I believe this is a miraculous event, but this is one I'll just have to, you know, just have to accept what it is.
Well, what about Saint Bernadette? What did she experience in her life that would have led to whatever this is? I mean, barring that there's not a scientific reason why she's not decomposing.
Right.
I mean, I'm certainly not of the – I'm not one of these people who says this is completely unexplainable. I say this is something maybe we can't explain yet. Maybe we can't explain it at all. But, you know, it's very, very interesting to me. And I mean, as much as this is not going to happen – it would be great if science was allowed in there to take some kind of very small coral sample to be able to tell what's going on within her pigment and her skin and all of that. That is not allowing this to happen.
I understand.
But what happened kind of back in her life? What did she experience that would have led to something like this?
Well, she's basically an innocent soul, if you will. She came from a poverty-stricken background, very Christian oriented. Her whole life was just. To become a nun, essence. I mean, that was one of her sisters was a nun, and as I recall, of course, before she entered the convent, she experienced this apparition. But I guess basically an innocent soul, if you will. I mean, it was why did she deserve this kind of treatment, or why is she selected out for this special treatment?
Right.
I would say a guileless, innocent soul type, and okay. I think that's why Mary, at least, it's just an assessment and just a guess. But that's why Mary appeared to a lot of peasant children in France, because they were fairly sweethearted and not worldly, if you will. Mm. And Bernadette necessarily was a saintly person in herself. I don't know. Mm. It seems like she was just a good-hearted type.
So she was never like an apparition witness or spoke to the Virgin Mary or anything?
Oh, she did see the Virgin Mary, yes.
She did?
Yes, she was a seer at Lourdes.
Okay. Okay.
And the Virgin Mary told her where to dig, and here's another little weirdness. The Virgin Mary told her where to dig during one of these appearances, and at first it started to be a trickle. It turned out to be like something like 20,000 gallons of water a day came out of what was a trickle, and
right.
where the Virgin Mary told her to dig in front of a lot of witnesses, and which was in striking. And because the Virgin Mary said there'd be a stream that she was consecrating to her, and blah, 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 for Bernadette to dig there, and that's what happened. And that was the substance of it. But that, in Lourdes, that was a apparitional event that had but one witness.
And that was St. Bernadette. Okay, so Bernadette is Lourdes. Okay.
Right.
Now, when we talk about the miraculous medal, St. Catherine Labour, am I saying that right? Labour?
Labour, yeah.
Tell me about that, because that is accompanied with a symbol.
It is. That happened in Rue de Bac, France. That's just a street in Paris. But basically, Catherine's sister was a nun. Catherine wanted to join the convent as well, and did. And the Virgin Mary appeared to her in that convent on Rue de Bac, 1830, and Rue de Bac Street in Paris. And the Virgin Mary instructor to have this medal designed of that, of its, the miraculous medal of its design, as probably people are familiar with, and over a billion have been struck from that design. And there have been many different cures and miracles alleged to have occurred relative to the use of this metal. Now, that's right. That's really all I know.
Right.
But there was a lot of smoke and fire with Catherine Labor's experience. Besides the metal, she also had an apparition of Jesus herself, and she also had some prophetic things told to her that the local bishop would be stripped of his duds by the crowd, and that actually happened about a week later, and of course that gave great credibility to Catherine Labor's statements. Huh. And that had never happened quite as dramatically as that before. And like I say, these are just all, that's what I meant earlier, is these all form a mosaic of authenticity if you add them all together. It just, it's pretty striking.
As far as the medal goes, I mean, on the front of it you have Mary. And on the opposite side, you have an M,
right,
with a cross, with a cross section bar going. I mean, we've got the standard, you know, crucifix cross, but then below that, as a base up to that cross, is a straight line with an M, and the M is intertwined within the base of that cross thing. Underneath of that, we've got a heart with a crown of thorns and the fire coming out the top, and the other one is a heart. Fire coming out the top with a sword going through it.
Right.
Then we have 12 stars, which I'm going to take a wild leap here and say that's the 12 apostles.
Probably.
Okay. So is there any literal translation by anyone? Did Mary say what this symbology meant or what it was supposed to represent?
Other than saying, no, she didn't like go into chapter and verse that I know of on it.
Mm-hmm.
Just said, indicate to have this medal struck after this model. All who wear it will receive great graces. They should wear it around the neck. Graces will abound for those who wear it with confidence, end quote. That's all I know. I mean, as a researcher, that's all. Now, there may have been more that I didn't come to find out, but that's about all I knew.
Was that just drawn by St. Catherine? I mean, was that?
Yes.
It was drawn down, and then she had it, you know, obviously cleaned up and struck.
Yeah, her confessor took it, and they had it made, struck at that point.
And those are not supposed to be made out of any precious metal.
Now, that I don't know either. I hadn't dealt – the metal, I included it but as part of the apparition, but I didn't really stress too much the, you know, elements of the who, right, what, and why I brought the metal.
I mean, you had mentioned earlier on pivotal moments of Marian apparitions.
Yeah.
What kind of pivotal moments are we talking about? Are we talking about incredibly liminal states in the world during times of seeing her?
Well, like in the 1531 deal with Juan Diego, that was at a time where the Spanish were treating the Indians like subhumans, enslaving them, this, that, and the other for the most part. And when she appeared to Juan Diego, that elevated the status of the Indians and the Spanish ideas, too. If the Virgin Mary is going to appear to this Indian, they must be all right kind of principle. And it did moderate the Spanish's treatment very much of the Indians, and it also was basically the beginning of the New World, and I guess 600 million people eventually became Christians and Catholics and so forth as a result of that episode. And other things like the Fatima pivotal experiences right before World War II, and she came up with a prophecy very typical at that time. But also, there's other ones that are not as well known, like at Pontmain, France, in the 1870s. You know, the Germans were invading France again, like they always do, and the local populace had a background of revering the Virgin Mary and, calling on her for intercession, as Catholics do.
Mm-hmm.
And what had happened is they were afraid of the Germans, understandably, and they prayed that their town would be spared. And basically, Mary did appear to a family in that town, and some other related witnesses. And the Germans actually got back to the Germans that the Virgin Mary was appearing to these townspeople in France. They turned around and didn't invade, which was kind of striking. But that's not the only time that's happened. There is a a legend, if you will, or modern legend, that in 1920, the Russians were going to invade Poland. And they're right at the, you know, Warsaw. All they had to do was cross over the Vistula River to invade, take over the country, like always. And they saw an image of the Virgin Mary in the sky in right near Warsaw. And the Russians turned tail, went all the way back to Moscow. And I swear it happened just that way. And this is a well authenticated story. I mean, I wasn't there. I don't have pictures like in some other things.
Sure,
but,
yeah.
But, I mean, this is in relatively modern times, 1920. And it was pretty illogical for the Russians to go to all the trouble to go to Warsaw and, you know, take it over and take over the country and all that, and then just turn around. And that's exactly what happened.
Curious. I mean,
go ahead.
I mean, we've had a gentleman by the name of Dr. David Clark on the show who talked about the Angel of Mons and why, well, basically how that whole story got started and how it was fictional. And essentially people heard that story and then took it literally, and then it became kind of a life of its own.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing. I mean, it's tough when you start talking about wartime and that kind of thing, because you've got all sorts of propaganda that surrounds war and all sorts of, you know, the powers that be everywhere are on our side type of thing.
Curious that
the Russians would turn around and go back.
I mean, the general in charge is going to have to explain to his superiors, why'd you just turn around, buddy? I mean, what kind of deal is this? I mean, I don't know. I mean, in other words, something like that would not be taken lightly. And actually, that's, like I said, it happened at Pont Main, it happened in Warsaw, and it happened in the Philippines in the 1980s. So, I mean, apparitions, which basically forestalled a lot of, you know, murder and mayhem. And I guess that's what I was saying. There's a whole richness to this stuff. If you look at all the little things, that's pretty good. I mean, it really is.
You know, I'm thinking of another show now that was on our dear friend Oprah's network called Miracle Detectives. And and on that show, they went to the Holy Love campus because a woman there, Maureen Sweeney Tile, no doubt you've heard of her. You know, they showed some photographs on there that I ain't buying it for a New York minute.
I don't know. I'm not really familiar with that one.
So you're not familiar with Maureen Sweeney Tile, Kyle, at all?
No, I'm really not.
I mean, she's a woman who says that, you know, the Virgin Mary speaks to her and stuff like that. And
I'm not familiar with her, because I guess I only dealt with the one. I mean, I'm familiar with a lot of different ones.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, the more modern ones and the ones there's not really strong evidence and a decision made, I didn't concentrate as much on.
Oh, okay. Okay, so there absolutely is a little bit of a contingency of what gets in the book and what doesn't. And
well, yes, because I wanted to just deal in what I thought was pretty rock solid.
Mm-hmm.
There's evidence of, you know, witnesses of the pictures, and I say, because here once again, out of the say 200-300 that have occurred since 1900, there's only been a determination on probably 8 or 9, maybe 10.
Okay,
so. It's really, you know, I mean, the other ones, there's like in the back of the book, you'd see no decision, no decision, no decision once, you know, over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why in each and every little modern one I haven't studied, because, well, it's still up in the air.
Yeah. I mean, I was
even
telling
York, you know.
Right, right. I mean, I was telling Jeremy on the phone today that my aunt was a hardcore Catholic, and she was with the Salvation Army for decades, her and her husband, before he passed away. And I was reading, I don't know, I was probably, I want to say it was the first year of high school where I learned about Fatima. And I learned about it from the National Enquirer, where they were selling Lord's water. And I said, what is Lord's water? And to my mom, and she said, oh, there's Lord's and there's Fatima. And so I got a book about Fatima, and I was reading that. My Aunt Kathleen came up to visit. And when she saw this book on the table, she said, who's reading this? And I said, me. And I'm telling you, I got the what for. Because she said to me, do you believe that? And I said, it's pretty compelling stuff. So a lot of people saw this. She goes, well, I'm not doubting the event.
Right.
She said, but you do realize that our God is a God of nature, and God does not work within apparitions and this sort of thing.
But how the hell do they know?
Well, I don't know. I mean, this is what she was brought up with, and obviously been taught somewhere for it to be ingrained in her psyche to be that opposed to that notion.
Yeah, I know. But what I'm trying to say is that God, in the he's used angels in the Bible. You know, Lot had the angels appear to him.
Sure.
This and that. I mean, it's been a common experience. So.
Hey, you're preaching to the choir. I didn't buy it either.
No. I'm just saying that.
But I'm curious where people get that from.
I don't know. See, that's what I brought back about the George Norrie UFO thing.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, and I'm not knocking George. I want to be back on the show and all that. If you're listening. But what I'm saying is
he's not. Trust me.
Well, he might sometime. Who knows? but what I'm saying is okay. What I was saying about some of the aspects about the UFO issue with this is that let's look at this. If this has been going on for 2,000 years, and let's say the aliens are in back of it, what's their motive? To promote Catholicism?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're going to go holograph project this picture of the Virgin Mary, even have a couple prophecies come out, and we'll somehow, by some quirk trick of fate, have those come true. I mean, what would be their M.O. for this? I mean, even the aliens would have to go into an awful lot of trouble for an awful long time to do what?
Well, can I – let me just interject here for you because I'm not entirely sure how familiar you are with what we talk about on the show as far as the UFO stuff goes.
No.
Our kind of viewpoint on this is that I mean, of course, you know as well as anyone else does that the purveying overthought of the UFO is that it's an extraterrestrial culture of some sort coming here in craft and that sort of thing, or it's interdimensional. We look at this in more of a this is a some kind of force of some sort. What it is, we have no idea. Jeremy and I are both experiencers hardcore of this kind of thing. That's why we do this show to begin with. And so when we're looking at, just say, the UFO problem as a whole, we're not buying a whole lot of what ufology has to offer about what the UFO is.
I know. People try to describe what they don't understand, basically.
Yeah. And essentially, when we had Jacques Vallée on the show and we were talking about all these ancient sightings of very strange things, right. Some of them were, as you mentioned earlier in the show, a man sees Mary. She says, build a church here. He builds the church there and then life goes on. What I kind of personally took away from that, even though Jacques disagreed with me, was that there seems to be some kind of force that is not just Marian apparitions, not just UFOs, not just ghosts or any of this other paranormal stuff in the big ball that we put that in.
Yeah.
It is something that either feels like it's leading you around by the nose or is somehow gently nudging you or guiding you or suggesting things.
Right.
And this is even present in psychedelic experiences, oddly enough. This is the same type of thing where they've almost made the connections that early man at some point was influenced by something else, which some people will call ancient aliens, some people will call psychedelics, some people will call whatever. So I mean, I see where you're going, kind of like what would be the motive. Well, here's my question for this. What would be what is in my head essentially when it comes to religion and the story of Jesus and Mary and all of that? We're at some point, if you're a godly person, you believe that there's going to be a showdown between the forces of evil and good. And my question has always been, since I was a little kid, is not so much in this verbiage, but why the dog and pony show?
I know. There's things I can't answer, I'll be honest with you.
Sure, of course. I don't expect you to. It's like that's one of the things that I look at and I say in the sense of, okay, Mary gave birth to Jesus. Jesus was the Son of God, or so a lot of people believe in their own religions and own rites. But what is her motive for appearing to peasant children in France, or this kind of thing, giving a medal that will kind of receive great graces to people in that way by wearing this thing? I mean, do you feel like ultimately, if you had to take a wild stab at it, would it be that this is something that is reinforcing faith or more than that?
I think, in my best opinion, and here mm-hmm. again, I'm just a fella. You know, I might
that's okay. You're anyway. Perfectly welcome to that.
But in my best opinion, it is nothing but an undergirding of faith. That's all.
Hmm.
And I think that mankind needs it because, you know, we forget everything we ever do. I mean, we forget our diets. We forget to not, you know, keep bad habits. We're just a very forgetful and mind-blown bunch. And I think we need to be reminded of faith, and I think that's the position God would take if the basic overall dynamics are true and God loves us and, you know, he's had this ongoing experience with us, then, you know, you throw in a messenger every now and then to do, you know, spice things up. And the Bible does underscore her actual place in the sun, too, because, like in the book of John, Jesus is on the cross, he's telling his disciple, you know, here is your mother. I mean, it wasn't like it's old Aunt Phyllis down the road. It was like somebody of, you know, more than has a place in the sun of things, not just, you know, here's my mother or whatever. So, and other things in the Bible, there's been other apologetics for Mary's position in the scheme of things. Mm-hmm. It says in Luke that, you know, generations will call me blessed. Well, I mean, that seems to have been the case.
Mm-hmm.
And, but what I'm saying is, I don't know, if I was God, I'd do things differently. I'll tell you that.
Wouldn't we all?
I'm just a no-nonsense ex-army guy. I'd fix stuff. I'd fix it today.
Mm.
But why he does things the way he does, I don't know.
Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Do you think there's anything to – this is another thing we've talked a lot about on this show is focus of intent and manifestation.
Mm-hmm.
And do you ever – does it ever cross your mind that I'm going to get so much shit for this in the after chat, I know, or the aftermath of the show rather that, but I'm going to say it anyway. I mean, when people are in times of desperation and people are in times of, well, they're in those liminal states where they're between a rock and a hard place.
They have a psychic vision, you're saying, basically?
Is it possible that in the sense of prayer and focusing on salvation and deliverance and all of these things, that of course Mary and Jesus, they for a lot of people, this embodies those kind of qualities.
Yeah.
And I wonder if this doesn't if reality doesn't respond in some way to essentially give you what you ask for in not so many
ways. It's some kind of manifestation of their desires.
Well, sort of, yeah. I mean,
well, you know,
and that doesn't negate any kind of external entity here. I mean,
right. I know what you're saying. Yeah, you know, in some cases that could be so, but in all these varied cases, just in a small little microcosm where it wasn't actually an apparition of Mary, but some little borderline event that happens in Catholicism, like that odor of sanctity format,
mm-hmm.
I was no more thinking about anything of any note or expecting a miracle. I mean, I was mostly just snooping. And, and I mean, I was not in any state that was anything but happy, you know? Mm-hmm. Or, I mean, I wasn't anticipating good times, bad times, anything. I was just
you weren't looking for an event, yeah.
But what I'm saying is that, and all the people that experienced all that stuff in Zaytun, Egypt, with the millions of witnesses of that format, they weren't all in some, you know, religious fervor that more mm-hmm. or less psychologically induced a hallucination. No, and most of these witnesses, the Juan Diego types and some others, are basically just walking or going about their little pedestrian business and not really thinking about anything except here. Oh, what's this? You know.
Yeah. Well, curious that in some of those cases, like I'm sure there were skeptical people in Egypt. I'm sure that there were.
Oh, yeah.
You mentioned there were skeptical people at Fatima. You know that. I mean, that's all very curious. I mean, it's a large amount of people.
Yeah. And almost 80,000 to 100,000 is what they've estimated the crowd was at Fatima.
It's crazy.
And it's crazy. Many, of course, millions and the Egypt thing, but there's not been any repressed. Debunking of this, not at all.
Right.
There's been no evidence of debunking in either Fatima or Zaytun, and I have looked. There ain't any.
Yeah, well, the only thing I've ever heard about Fatima is by skeptical bunch is that it was a mass delusion or mass, mass temporary, hypnotic trance type of thing. I'm not buying it.
I don't know
what happened at Fatima, but it sure as hell wasn't anything normal as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I know damn little about it. I'll be honest with you. But what I've read about it, it's like this. I mean, you could look at the most basic facts here about this thing and not see what people are talking about. In fact, there's the next big question. There's one picture. Am I correct of Fatima?
I have a picture of the crowd.
But is there not one picture of the event?
I did not find one of the event. I found one of the crowd that was staring and aghast at what was in the sky.
Hmm.
But I did not find one of the photo of the event. No, I did not find it. It may exist, but I didn't find it. I mean, I haven't found everything, but I did
see,
not
I'd seen
it.
One on the net a while back that purported to be the only photograph of there. And it was, you're right, looking over top the crowd and and the sky was just, I mean, this photograph, it's not like you could make out extreme detail, but
the one I've got in the book, but
the sky was a disaster. I mean, whatever was going on was wild.
Yeah, they were kind of shocked. I mean, I'm looking at the one I have in the book, and the crowd is looking up in the sky, in earnest shock or whatever you want to call it, but it doesn't show anything hopping and bopping around in the sky. It's just basically the crowd.
No. Right, right.
I've got that picture in the book, yeah.
Are you familiar with Emmitsburg Grotto?
I've read about it. The jury's out on that, as far as I know.
Do you know the story about what happened there?
Just in sketchy terms, and I've basically forgotten what I did know.
Okay.
I hate to let you down in that.
No, that's okay. I mean, that is a replica of Lourdes, am I correct? I mean, that was all it was really.
They actually had a negative decision on Emmitsburg in 94.
Oh, okay.
And, I mean, actually they found some negative things that would detract from the validity of that. And as I indicated earlier, when I found one that really was a negative, I just went on to issues that had some validity or.
Right, like right. I mean, the reason I ask about that is my grandfather is the one who set the Statue of Mary. He was a crane operator. And, He sat the massive statue that sticks out of the treetops there. And I always wondered, like, we go to Emmitsburg every year because my granddad set the statue. Ever since he passed away, we go there every year to see the statue. And just because of the family connection to it. And, I always walked around there going, did something happen here? Because there's an awful lot of people here, and there seems to be this purveying thought of apparitions and that sort of thing, and I hear people chatting about it, and I always wondered, was there anything there or not?
I know what you're saying. Well, now I've gotten a blast of flack sometimes from people who've asked me about what apparitions are perhaps questionable, and I've said that, to my knowledge, there's a big question mark on the one in Conyers, Georgia. Mm-hmm. And I've gotten callers into like coast to coast that were just chomping all over me for that.
Yeah.
Because I mean, oh, there's a little, well, maybe it is. But see, there is a possibility in the church and in other things that people, that humans deal with, to make mistakes. Mm-hmm. And there's certainly been many, many legal decisions which have been erroneous. And it's possible their assessment of some of the facts in these cases has not been valid. I wouldn't doubt that for 5 seconds.
Mm.
So all I can say is the preponderance of evidence looks like Conyers was not good and Emmitsburg was too, according to the church.
Mm.
But I can't say with any absolute certainty that Conyers didn't have validity. Now, something I mentioned in the book in the early part of it and the introduction that one of the troubles is that we have to really believe, oh, our whole society is based on what other people say.
Mm-hmm.
And I know people lie and
sure.
They make mistakes and they misidentify stuff. But by and large, you still are bound to look at the simplest explanation is usually the right one. If someone tells me, like I know people that I've seen a ghost, okay, and people could, say, oh, you're a crock. You didn't see a ghost. Well, how do you know? The point is, mm-hmm. I believe if so many people earnestly have said they've seen ghosts for such an incredible amount of time in every face of the earth, from every civilization, that there's some validity to the phenomenon. Individual examples, don't know. But obviously, just like in the UFO instance where there's smoke, there's fire. But we do have to believe what people say. Mm-hmm. I've never been to Mount Everest, but I have to believe that it's there because I've always heard it is.
Right.
And that people should not always dismiss what people say. I guess that applies in apparitions and other things too. That's just a small point. I don't mean to belabor it.
No, that's okay. Well, I got one more for you, and then I'm going to let Jeremy take it over and wrap up.
Okay.
I don't look at this phenomena or the UFO phenomena or any of these things as being too tightly confined by time, at least not as far – I mean, maybe as far as our perception of it, but maybe not as far as the phenomena itself. I'm taking it that, of course, all of these apparitions would have come after the time of the biblical times. I mean, we don't have visions of Jesus Christ walking before he walked the earth. Is there any weird things that you see in very, very ancient times that appear to you to look like you know how we do in the UFO field? People look at cave drawings and go, that's a flying saucer. Is there anything like that as it applies to something in a Mirian, apparition?
To the best of my knowledge, there's
nothing that's before that time period.
To the best of my knowledge, now I don't know everything in every case, but I,
right.
to the best of my knowledge, this phenomenon started occurring in 40 AD and has occurred pretty frequently thereafter. I know the cave dwellings you're talking about. I saw that at the Roswell UFO Festival about a year ago, where they had,
right. And I'm going to steal one more before you go. You know, ufology is pretty well known for its distrust of the government. The government knows this and knows that. I personally don't feel it knows anything, but that's me. Does the Catholic Church or any church take the place of the government in Marian apparitions? Do you think they know more than they're telling? Do you think they cover things up? Do you think that they're holding?
Yes, they have. They have. But I think, yes, they have. And I get in trouble for that, but I get in trouble for so many things. I can't keep track of them. But there's been some, there seems to be, let's put it this way, there seems to be a strong undercurrent of thought that there's more to the third secret of Fatima, for example, than made known.
That's what I was alluding to. Yeah,
there's even a group called Fatimists that met in May of 2010 in Rome. They had a man named Christopher Ferrara that is a U.S. attorney and very, very familiar with investigations. And to paraphrase him, he said, "There's no way that what they told us is what this was. There's just no way. I mean, there's more left on the table that's not being discussed."
Right.
And that's all I could really say at this point on that. But I mean.
It's the Mogul balloon of the Fatima, you know. It's the Mogul balloon exclusive.
That comes right from the Catholic News Service too. So.
Right. Yeah. Wow. So, okay.
Well, yes, there's some things like that.
On a similar note, I guess I have a final question, which is: have governments tried to cover it up, and/or have they scrambled jets after these apparitions?
To the best of my knowledge, there's been nothing like that in the scrambled jets kind of format. No, most governments don't really seem to. They basically keep their mitts off of it, even like the Egyptian example, even though they were basically... Oh, by the way, Muslims actually do venerate the Virgin Mary. They do. She does have a place in the sun with them, I mean, if you will, as opposed to just another woman. She's revered, if you will. But basically, no, they're not going to endorse Christianity, even though they might think Mary's a fine example of motherhood and so forth. But what I'm saying is that they have not really tried to suppress this, to my knowledge, except in little examples, little petty examples, like in Portugal, the socialists tried to put it down because they didn't really want the church to be endorsed or something like that. There's been little petty examples, but nothing like in the UFO field where I feel there's real censorship. No.
And really, this will be my last one, but I just thought of it. Do these have a duration? I mean, how long do they last generally?
Well, generally, now Catherine Labor had apparitions of the Virgin Mary for many years, but I don't think any of them have lasted as long as the 30 years the Medjugorje experience has been going on. Usually they're actually fairly short duration, like, 6 months or a year. Now, in Borang and Banau, Belgium, the apparitions actually, she kept appearing to this particular seer for many, many years too, but off and on. But most of them are short duration within a period of from one day to 2 weeks or a month or something like that.
And when they stop appearing, do they announce? Does Mary announce she's not going to appear after such and such a date?
Yes.
Interesting. Well, Kevin Cook, thank you very much for talking Marian Apparitions with us. The book is Marian Apparitions Are Real, and the website is marianapparitionsarereal.com. So that's simple enough to remember.
Yeah, if they need the book in the e-book form or anything like that, they can get it at Barnes & Noble or just order directly or walk into a Barnes & Noble and get one.
All right, great.
And I do have that radio show, liveparanormal.com, on Fridays at 11 Eastern.
liveparanormal.com, and that's the station. What is your show called? Live Paranormal?
No, it's Paranormal Mysteries.
Paranormal Mysteries on liveparanormal.com.
Yes.
Very good. All right. Well, thank you, sir.
You're more than welcome. I appreciate you.
All right. Have a good night.
You too.
You've been listening to Paratopia with Jeffrey Ritzman and Jeremy Vinn. And I could care less.
So the Jeff.
So the Jer.
Here we are, yet again, at the end of another episode of Paratopia. And
that's
what
right.
have we learned? What have we learned, Jeff?
That 100,000 plus people gathered together in one place are not fervent. Sorry. I'm sorry, Kevin. I'm not – I meant to bring that up when we were speaking. But, when he mentioned that – and I think this is a – it's an interesting wrinkle that just, I don't know, kind of presents itself when you look at the whole of the paranormal. And we've talked a lot on this show about focus of intent and liminal states and marginality and all that. And then manifestations happen. This is not to say the manifestations aren't real. That's not what that means. But it's what is it made of? What is its mechanic? That sort of thing. And on one hand, you could look and say, this is the this is coming to us via the pipeline from God. Or you can say, is this possibility that that many people gather together in one place? That's more people than Woodstock. That's what's over three times more. Think about that. Go watch Woodstock tonight, people. Look at that crowd. You're talking about a crowd three times larger, more than, gathered together in one place for this thing. So I don't think we can really say that crowd wasn't worked up and fervored to see something miraculous. And when something miraculous happened, well, there you are. I mean, it's I could easily make the argument that was generated by one of the largest groupings of people ever assembled on the planet, and that's a valid point to mention. So I don't buy that those people weren't fervored or at least worked up and focused on it. So I don't know. I mean, if you can put aside all of your theological questions or doubts or all of that, and just look at a phenomena that's occurring, I think it's an interesting phenomena. I certainly think the Egypt thing, I'm going to look more into the Egypt thing and Our Lady of Guadalupe, because I'll be damned if I've ever heard of anything that looks like that. And you guys can look on our message board and see that in this show thread. I'll be damned if that's not pigment. I mean, I can't buy that. Until I lay eyes on it, that looks every bit like a painting. I mean, if it's been examined by a lab, I'm going to look at that and I'm going to try and find out someone, I can contact at that lab who maybe looked at it and maybe we can get some kind of opinion on that. But if that's truly I'll put it this way, there can't be no pigment. There can't be. It's impossible for an image to exist without pigment on a medium surface. So what is the pigment? I know what the medium is. What's the pigment? Is the pigment gathered within the cell structure of the cactus skin or husk? That would be interesting. I'd want to know how that happened. The only thing that I can think of, and again, I'm not buying the people so long ago wouldn't know how to do this or bullshit. People can figure out a lot of things.
The whole time I was thinking Da Vinci.
Yeah, I mean, is it possible that there is maybe natural juices or chemicals that can invoke a pigmented response in the inside of that husk? And has some kind of culture maybe stumbled onto that or found something that works like that? And is that what we're seeing? But I look at that and I go, if that were photographically perfect, if it were so incredibly rich in dimension and form, I would go, that is pretty amazing. But that looks every bit of its era of art. It looks every bit of a painting to me, and it looks every bit of human perception and the application of art onto a medium. It looks like art to me. It's beautiful, but it looks like art.
Well, here's a question. I just know a little bit about how the art world works from dealing with Melissa Reed's trying to get a painting sort of dated and trying to figure out who the artist is. And that's that to preserve these paintings, they wash them. They do all sorts of things to them. They fill in the pigments, you know, that might be missing in something.
Right.
Could all of that sort of process of taking apart a painting and putting it back together, you know, if you're dealing with cactus skin, could that actually take away the pigment from whatever instrument one is using to examine it in a lab?
I'm not sure I follow how you're...
it's not as though he's saying that a lab looked at this and said there's no pigment, right?
There's no pigment on the medium, that's right.
So could that not be because whatever they were doing to preserve this thing all of these years sort of manipulated it in such a way that pigment wouldn't show up in the way that a lab would be searching for it? Because I guess, you know, as far as paintings go, the actual painting that you're looking at in a museum ain't the painting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that painting's gone. What you're looking at is something that has been not just retouched, but I mean, we're talking like washed. We're talking restructured on the canvas, all sorts of stuff.
Mm.
So when we're talking about a cactus shell or husk, what goes into keeping the maintenance up on that?
Well, I mean, as far as it goes with paintings, I mean, if you're talking about like Van Gogh or Renoir and all those, I mean, those have been restored, but you know, I've watched them do restoration of paintings and whatnot when I was back in college, and I mean, the washing of them, it's an extraordinarily delicate process that they use to do that. Number one, because they don't want to damage the structure or the bond of the oil paint onto the canvas. I mean, that's their biggest worry, is they're going to remove something. But when they actually retouch something, they are working on the most minute of areas in order to, like, if you've got crazing or something like that in an oil painting, which is really common with age, and even if you're looking at like potboiler paintings of today, those will craze within 10 to 15 years, and that's a modern oil paint. So I'm not necessarily seeing that you're not seeing the actual painting, but you're seeing spots on that painting that are genuinely not from the artist's hand who painted it. There's a lot of restoration that's going on with a lot of paintings out there.
So what sort of restoration would go into a cactus?
Well, here's what I'm thinking. I mean, if a lab has examined and said there's no pigment there, that means that on some level, I would expect to have had a small sample taken of a pigmented area, of an area of that painting that, or an area of that husk that shows color. Somehow, and that would then have to be chemically examined and separated to say what is the pigment that is making that up, and then that person would have to tell me there is no pigment there. The color that you are seeing is the husk, which I think is what is being said here. If that's the case, okay, I'll take that as a little weird. If they're just examining it through a microscope and saying there's no pigment there, I'm not sure that I would buy that. As an artist myself, I have seen mediums that you can paint on that, for lack of a better word, the minute that the brush hits it, it's soaking it up, and then you can wipe that thing. You can wipe the surface pigment off, and the actual item, the actual medium, is stained. I have to wonder if this is in a staining process rather than.
That's what I'm getting at.
Yeah, a surface paint.
Sort of tattooed.
Exactly, exactly. But if they did a. If they did a chemical makeup of what that is and they didn't come away with anything but husk, I would want a deeper analysis of the nature of that husk and what does it have as opposed to a control sample where there is no pigment at all. What are the differences? That's where you would find any trace of pigment that would be there to make it the color that it is.
And when did they do these tests?
That's another thing we've got to find out. I mean, I'm ultra jazzed because I am going to look into that because if there's nothing there, I can't think of any way that it would be there without pigment. There is pigment, or you wouldn't see it. The question is, what is the pigment? To say there's no pigment is wrong. I mean, there's pigment if you can see an image. Otherwise, you just see the husk. So there, it's either a husk of the pigment, you know, the pigment of the husk, or it's not. So what? Which is it?
Well, the idea is that it's a miracle, right?
That's the idea. But, you know, I got to say, when I was mentioning that show with the good-looking host that was on here some years back, that show did a great job. I mean, she was very respectful of people's belief systems, but I think there was – and I'll never remember the name of this, but somebody out there probably in the listener land will remember it. There's a church that has the blood of a saint, and it's in kind of like a, I don't know, it's in something that kind of reminds me of the Holy Hand Grenade from the Monty Python movie. It's in a globe, and it's dried. And it's on like a standard that they walk around through the crowd, or they parade it through this particular route. And if this blood liquefies, that means that you know, there's going to be prosperity and good things for this town or this community. And I remember her saying that one year it did not liquefy, and something bad happened. And then it does almost every year. And she was there when they were parading it around, and sure enough, it liquefied. However, she went to scientists and said, look at this. How would you explain this? And then they showed you how two chemicals can not mix together. You wouldn't see, just kind of like oil and water. You would see this, the oil settles to the bottom of water. And if this were in a globe completely sealed, you wouldn't see the water. You'd only see the oil. And if the oil would then become solid, whatever matter was in this thing, the scientist said it could be this. If you sit it still, it will harden. When you move it and you change the temperature, it liquefies. Did they explain it? They explained how it could have been done, but they don't say this conclusively proves it. But there is a way it can be done. She was very good about kind of exposing certain things as it's curious, but it's not impossible. It's not a miracle. Even with St. Bernadette, I mean, that picture on our message board right now, you can see she is a pretty woman, and she's been dead for a very long time. Again, why? I don't know. That's why I was asking about, is there a conspiracy theory with the Vatican? Like, are they propping her up somehow? Is that really her in there? You can't go up and touch her. She's in a glass coffin. Is it really her? Is it a wax figure? Is this being done to bolster faith? And I mean, I don't know. It's like they say, trust no one. What did I say this week? Trust no one. I've got to put my hands on it. I've got to see it. I want to talk to somebody. Ugh. You know, I know, but you know, is that really her? Because if that's really her, she looks amazing. What is the process? Somebody get a core sample of St. Bernadette. I want to know what is doing that. Is it a miracle? I don't know if it's a miracle, but it's certainly wild. When you think about the Egyptian mummies, and they say those people, look how well they're preserved. Blew. They look like human beef jerky. Yeah, are they very old? Yes. But they say it's amazing that the mummy has lips and eyelids and a little bit of hair. That's amazing. And it is amazing. But look at Saint Bernadette. She looks like she was just laid out yesterday. That's crazy.
By the way, to your question about whether there have been Marian visions prior to this, yeah. I mean, if you look to other cultures, the answer is yes.
Mm-hmm.
She just wasn't called Mary. She was called other things. And in fact, if you look to, once again, Kundalini is considered the, you know, the feminine serpent or whatever, you know, all of that, who speaks to you. I mean, there is something about the sacred feminine that has been with us throughout time that these Marian visions would appear to be a part of if you allow yourself outside of your particular box to see that.
Right.
Then, you know, it's there for you to see.
Curious. I don't know. I mean,
curious, sir.
It's interesting. I mean, I thought it was interesting. I like to read the book. I like to see how deep it gets. I mean, it's a podcast and you've only got a limited amount of time, but, you know, Kevin seemed kind of like, I don't know, he kind of just glazed over certain things, which we were covering a lot. So that's fine. But I want to know more. I want to know deeper. I want to know what the analysis was on this and that and who did the analysis. And I mean, the Huss thing is really bothering me. So I've got to find out more about that. But it's an interesting phenomenon. I'll give it that.
Yes, indeed. Well, Jeff, we have come to the end of our rope. Time, show.
Have we already?
Haven't we already?
Yeah.
Any final words on our way out the dough?
Well, I do have one thing that's curious, and I'm just, again, I'm mentioning it for the drinking crowd. And because I think this would be a good way to kind of catalog this stuff. Somebody's keeping track somewhere, I'm sure. Somebody who doesn't like me, probably. Sunday night, I went to bed pretty late, 3 a.m. probably, roundabout, and went right to sleep, and something woke me up. I didn't know what time, but it was still dark outside. And I woke up from a dead sleep to wide awake. And I'm laying there on my right side, and on the ceiling, there seemed to be a red, not direct light, but indirect light, as if there was a light beside me in the bed that was shining on the ceiling. It was very, very red, and there seemed to be, like, here's a probably a good experiment. Go into a dark room. If you have any kind of, well, your computer monitor would probably be a good way to do it. Put a red screen on your computer monitor, turn all the lights out, aim your monitor at the ceiling if you've got plasma or LCD, and kind of wave your hand in front of it. You won't see a hand. You'll just see a dark kind of half shadow within this indirect light that's on the ceiling. That's what I was seeing. I was seeing a red reflected light with something blocking it out at certain intervals that was of not a clear enough shape to be able to discern what it was. So immediately, knowing that my wife, myself, and my son all just got new smartphones, my wife is probably woke up in the middle of the night and is playing with something on her phone. And I'm thinking to myself, God, would she just go back to sleep and put the phone down? And about that time, the toilet flushes in the bathroom. And I think, ah, here comes my kid. He's going to duck his head in here and say, what are you doing? Lisa comes out of the bathroom. And as soon as she comes out of the bathroom, the light on the ceiling is gone. And I said, okay. And I look over on the table where, you know, she puts her chargers and all that. The phone is off. The iPod is off. There's nothing making any light. Our alarm clock is a very, very pale, low light blue color.
Wait, how did you not know your wife wasn't next to you?
Well, I didn't move.
Oh, yeah, I didn't. You were on your back looking at the
screen? No, I was on my right side. Oh, I was on my right side facing the door. She's on the back of me. And I didn't even roll over. I just looked up and I saw that and I thought, well, she's just messing with her phone. And then when she came out of the bathroom and it was gone, I was like, wait a minute. So what the hell was that? We have Venetian blinds in our room. They were shut tight. No lamps were on. There was literally no source of light at all in the room aside from the alarm clock, which is, like I said, a very pale whitish blue. So I don't know what that was. But damn, I mean, this thing was actually casting a shadow on the small frame that's on the ceiling that encompasses our pull down stairs for the attic. I mean, I saw a shadow of this reflected light on that, you know, on that frame. It was casting a shadow. What it was, I haven't a clue. But it was there, I don't know, 2 minutes? I mean, maybe almost 2 minutes. I was laying there just looking at it going, pfft. I shut my eyes and I'd look up again. It'd still be there. And then I hear the toilet flush and out she comes. So I don't know what that was, but I'm just putting that down in the notepad. And anybody playing a drinking game, it's your shot.
Well, there you have it, folks.
There you are.
All right. I got nothing I want to talk about.
Okay.
Good night, everybody.
Good night. Well, let me ask you this. What did the academic have to say about that? What you can't talk about, that it's complete nonsense, it's utter left field, or that he's never heard of it. I mean, there's a definitive difference between I've never heard of anything like that to it's nonsense.
No, he's saying it's nonsense. And that what he really said, which makes more sense to me than anything, is that Phil needs to give me something, right? He could give a transcript. He could, in fact, I asked him last week for the name of a professor, right?
Yeah.
A pretty reasonable request, and I still haven't heard back yet.
Mm.
Now he does. Ah, what the fuck? Hold on. Oh my god, that scared the shit out of me.
What?
I thought a giant bug just tried to land on me, but it was actually sponge from my headphones flying into my face and landing on the heater.
gotta leave that in. Good lord.
Anyway, where was I? What was I just saying?
I have no idea. I'm too ensued with the hilarity of this. God, I wish I'd have been there for
I thought
that.
A giant cockroach just flew into my mouth. I was like, what?